not even knowing it. He remembered well enough what Captain Farron had said. Beyond the outposts, the western road goes into nowhere, or into hell. I've heard it said that God himself never ventures beyond the outposts. Jack shivered a little. But he really didn't believe he had come so far. Certainly there was none of the steadily deepening unease he had been feeling before he floundered into the living trees in his effort to get away from Morgan's diligence, the living trees which now seemed like a hideous prologue to all the time he had spent in Oatley. Indeed, the good emotions he had felt from the time he woke up warm and rested inside the haystack until the time Henry the farmer had invited him to jump down from his wagon had now resurfaced. That feeling that the territories, in spite of whatever evil they might harbor, were fundamentally good, and that he could be a part of this place any time he wanted, that he was really no stranger at all. He had come to realize that he was part of the territories for long periods of time. A strange thought had come to him as he swung easily along the western road, a thought which came half in English and half in whatever the territory's language was. When I'm having a dream, the only time I really know it's a dream is when I'm starting to wake up. If I'm dreaming and just wake up all at once, if the alarm clock goes off or something, then I'm the most surprised guy alive. At first, it's the waking that seems like a dream, and I'm no stranger over here when the dream gets deep. Is that what I mean? No, but it's getting close. I bet my dad dreamed deep a lot, and I'll bet Uncle Morgan almost never does. He had decided he would take a swig on a Speedy's bottle and flip back the first time he saw anything that might be dangerous, even if he saw anything scary. Otherwise, he would walk all day over here before returning to New York. In fact, he might have been tempted to spend the night in the territories if he'd had anything to eat beyond the one apple, but he didn't, and along the wide, deserted dirt track of the western road, there was not a 7-Eleven or a stop-and-go in sight. The old trees which had surrounded the crossroads and the market town had given way to open grassland on either side once Jack got past the final small settlement. He began to feel that he was walking along an endless causeway which crossed the middle of a limitless ocean. He traveled the western road alone that day under a sky that was bright and sunny, but cool, late September now, of course it's cool, he thought. Except the word which came to mind was not September, but a territory's word which really did translate better as 9 months. No pedestrians passed him, no wagons either loaded or empty. The wind blew pretty steadily, sighing through the ocean of grasses with a low sound that was both autumnal and lonely. Great ripples ran across the grasses before that wind. If asked, "How do you feel, Jack?" the boy would have responded, "Pretty good, thanks. Cheerful." Cheerful is the word which would have come into his mind as he hiked through those empty grasslands. Rapture was a word he associated most easily with the pop hit of the same name by the rock group Blondie, and he would have been astounded if told he had wept several times as he stood watching those great ripples chase each other toward the horizon, drinking in a sight that only a very few American children of his time had ever seen, huge, empty tracts of land under a blue sky of dizzying width and breadth, and yes, even depth. It was a sky unmarked by either jet contrails across its dome or smutty bands of smog at any of its lower edges. Jack was having an experience of remarkable sensory impact, seeing and hearing and smelling things which were brand new to him, while other sensory input to which he had grown utterly accustomed was missing for the first time. In many ways, he was a remarkably sophisticated child, brought up in a Los Angeles family where his father had been an agent and his mother a movie actress. It would have been odder if he had been naive. But he was still just a child, sophisticated or not, and that was undeniably his gain, at least in a situation such as this. That lonely day's journey across the grasslands would surely have produced sensory overload, perhaps even a pervasive sense of madness and hallucination in an adult. An adult would have been scrabbling for Speedy's bottle, probably with fingers too shaky to grasp it very successfully, an hour west of the market town, maybe less. In Jack's case, the wallop passed almost completely through his conscious mind and into his subconscious. So when he blissed out entirely and began to weep, he was really unaware of the tears, except as a momentary doubling of vision, which he attributed to sweat, and thought only, "Geez, I feel good. It should feel spooky out here with no one around, but it doesn't." That was how Jack came to think of his rapture as no more than a good, cheerful feeling as he walked alone up the western road, with his shadow gradually growing longer behind him. It did not occur to him that part of his emotional radiance might stem from the fact that hardly less than 12 hours before, he had been a prisoner of Updike's Oatly Tap. The blood blisters from the last keg to land on his fingers were still fresh. That hardly less than 12 hours ago, he had escaped, barely, some sort of murdering beast that he had begun to think of as a were-goat. That for the first time in his life, he was on a wide, open road that was utterly deserted except for him. There was not a Coca-Cola sign anywhere in view, or a Budweiser billboard showing the world-famous Clydesdales. No ubiquitous wires ran beside the road on either side, or crisscrossed above it, as had been the case on every road Jack Sawyer had ever traveled in his entire life. There was not so much as even the distant rolling sound of an airplane, let alone the rolling thunder of the 747s on their final approaches to LAX, or the F-111s that were always blasting off from the Portsmouth Naval Air Station, and then cracking the air over the Alhambra like Osmond's whip as they headed out over the Atlantic. There was only the sound of his feet on the road and the clean ebb and flow of his own respiration. "Geez, I feel good," Jack thought, wiping absently at his eyes, and defined it all as cheerful. Now there was this tower to look at and wonder about. "Boy, you'd never get me up on that thing," Jack thought. He had gnawed the apple right down to the core, and without thinking about what he was doing or even taking his eyes off the tower, he dug a hole in the tough, springy earth with his fingers and buried the apple core in it. The tower seemed made of barn boards, and Jack guessed it had to be at least 500 feet high. It appeared to be a big hollow square, the boards rising on all sides in X after X. There was a platform on top, and Jack, squinting, could see a number of men strolling around up there. Wind pushed by him in a gentle gust as he sat at the side of the road, his knees against his chest and his arms wrapped around them. Another of those grassy ripples ran away in the direction of the tower. Jack imagined the way that rickety thing must be swaying and felt his stomach turn over. "Never get me up there," he thought, "not for $1 million." And then the thing he had been afraid might happen since the moment he had observed that there were men on the tower now did happen. One of them fell. Jack came to his feet. His face wore the dismayed, slack-jawed expression of anyone who has ever been present at a circus performance where some dangerous trick has gone wrong. The tumbler who falls badly and lies in a huddled heap. The aerialist who misses her grip and bounces off the net with a thud. The human pyramid that unexpectedly collapses, spilling bodies into a heap. "Oh, shit! Oh, cripes! Oh!" Jack's eyes suddenly widened. For a moment his jaw sagged even farther, until it was almost lying on his breastbone, in fact. And then it came up, and his mouth spread in a dazed, unbelieving grin. The man hadn't fallen from the tower, nor had he been blown off it. There were tongue-like protrusions on two sides of the platform. They looked like diving boards. And the man had simply walked out to the end of one of these and jumped off. Halfway down, something began to unfurl. A parachute, Jack thought, but it would never have time to open. Only it hadn't been a parachute. It was wings. The man's fall slowed, and then stopped completely while he was still some 50 feet above the high field grass. Then it reversed itself. The man was now flying upward and outward, the wings going up so high they almost touched, like the crowns on the heads of that Henny Youngman parrot, and then driving downward again with immense power, like the arms of a swimmer in a finishing sprint. Oh, wow, Jack thought, driven back to the dumbest cliché he knew by his total, utter amazement. This topped everything. This was an utter pisser. Oh, wow, look at that. Oh, wow. Now a second man leaped from the diving board at the top of the tower. Now a third. Now a fourth. In less than 5 minutes, there must have been 50 men in the air, flying complicated but discernible patterns. Out from the tower, describe a figure eight, back over the tower and out to the other side, another figure eight, back to the tower, a light on the platform, do it all again. They spun and danced and crisscrossed in the air. Jack began to laugh with delight. It was a little like watching the water ballets in those corny old Esther Williams movies. Those swimmers, Esther Williams herself most of all, of course, always made it look easy, as if you yourself could dip and swirl like that, or as if you and a few of your friends could easily come off the opposite sides of the diving board in timed choreography, making a kind of human fountain. But there was a difference. The men flying out there did not give that sense of effortlessness. They seemed to be expending prodigious amounts of energy to stay in the air, and Jack felt with sudden certainty that it hurt, the way some of the calisthenics in phys ed, leg lifts or halfway sit-ups, for instance, hurt. "No pain, no gain," Coach would roar if someone had the nerve to complain. And now something else occurred to him. The time his mother had taken him with her to see her friend Myrna, who was a real ballet dancer, practicing in the loft of a dance studio on Lower Wilshire Boulevard. Myrna was part of a ballet troupe, and Jack had seen her and the other dancers perform. His mother often made him go with her, and it was mostly boring stuff like church or sunrise semester on TV. But he had never seen Myrna in practice, never that close up. He had been impressed and a little frightened by the contrast between seeing ballet on stage, where everyone seemed to either glide or mince effortlessly on the tips of their points, and seeing it from less than 5 feet away, with harsh daylight pouring in the floor-to-ceiling windows and no music, only the choreographer rhythmically clapping his hands and yelling harsh criticisms. No praise, only criticisms. Their faces ran with sweat, their leotards were wet with sweat, the room, as large and airy as it was, stank of sweat. Sleek muscles trembled and fluttered on the nervous edge of exhaustion. Corded tendons stood out like insulated cables, throbbing veins popped out on foreheads and necks. Except for the choreographer's clapping and angry, hectoring shouts, the only sounds were the thrup-thud of ballet dancers on point moving across the floor and harsh, agonized panting for breath. Jack had suddenly realized that these dancers were not just earning a living, they were killing themselves. Most of all, he remembered their expressions, all that exhausted concentration, all that pain. But transcending the pain, or at least creeping around its edges, he had seen joy. Joy was unmistakably what that look was, and it had scared Jack because it had seemed inexplicable. What kind of person could get off by subjecting himself or herself to such steady, throbbing, excruciating pain? And pain that he was seeing here, he thought. Were they actual winged men like the bird people in the old Flash Gordon serials? Or were the wings more in the Icarus and Daedalus line, something that you strapped on? Jack found that it didn't really matter, at least not to him. Joy. They live in a mystery. These people live in a mystery. It's joy that holds them up. That was what mattered. It was joy that held them up, no matter if the wings grew out of their backs or were somehow held on with buckles and clamps. Because what he saw, even from this distance, was the same sort of effort he had seen in the loft on Lower Wilshire that day. All that profligate investment of energy to effect a splendid momentary reversal of natural law. That such a reversal should demand so much and last such a short time was terrible. That people would go for it anyway was both terrible and wonderful. "And it's all just a game," he thought, and suddenly felt sure of it. A game, or maybe not even that, maybe it was only practice for a game, the way that all the sweat and trembling exhaustion in the Wilshire loft that day had just been practice. Practice for a show that only a few people would probably care to attend, and which would probably close quickly. joy, he thought again, standing now, his face turned up to look at the flying men in the distance, the wind spilling his hair across his forehead. His time of innocence was fast approaching its end, and if pressed, even Jack would have reluctantly agreed that he felt such an end approaching. A boy couldn't go on the road for long, couldn't go through many experiences such as the one he had gone through in Oatley, and expect to remain an innocent. But in those moments, as he stood looking into the sky, innocence seemed to surround him, like the young fisherman during his brief moment of epiphany in the Elizabeth Bishop poem. Everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. Joy. Damn it, that's a cheerful little word. Feeling better than he had since all of this began, and only God knew just how long ago that had been, Jack set off along the western road again. His step light, his face wreathed in that same silly, splendid grin. Every now and then he looked back over his shoulder, and he was able to see the flyers for a very long time. The territory's air was so clear it almost seemed to magnify. And even after he could no longer see them, that feeling of joy remained, like a rainbow inside his head. When the sun began to go down, Jack realized he was putting off his return to the other world, to the American territories, and not just because of how terrible the magic juice tasted, either. He was putting it off because he didn't want to leave here. A streamlet had flowed out of the grasslands, where small groves of trees had again begun to appear, billowy trees with oddly flat tops like eucalyptus trees, and had hooked a right so that it flowed along beside the road. Farther off, to the right and ahead, was a huge body of water. It was so huge, in fact, that until the last hour or so, Jack had thought it was a patch of sky that somehow had a slightly bluer color than the rest. But it wasn't sky, it was a lake. A great lake, he thought, smiling at the pun. He guessed that in the other world that would be Lake Ontario. He felt good. He was headed in the right direction, maybe a little too far north, but he had no doubt that the western road would bend away from that direction soon enough. That feeling of almost manic joy, what he had defined as cheerfulness, had mellowed to a lovely sort of calm serenity, a feeling that seemed as clear as the territory's air. Only one thing marred his good feeling, and that was the memory 6 is 6, Jack was 6, of Jerry Bledsoe. Why had his mind given him such a hard time about coughing that memory up? No, not the memory, the two memories. First me and Richard hearing Mrs. Feeney telling her sister that the electricity came out and cooked him, that it melted his glasses all over his nose, that she heard Mr. Sloat talking on the phone and he said so, and then being behind the couch, not really meaning to snoop or eavesdrop, and hearing my dad say everything has consequences, and some of those consequences might be on the uncomfortable side. And something surely made Jerry Bledsoe uncomfortable, didn't it? When your glasses end up melting all over your nose, I'd say you'd been through something mildly uncomfortable, yes. Jack stopped. Stopped dead. What are you trying to say? You know what I'm trying to say, Jack. Your father was gone that day. He and Morgan both. They were over here. Where over here? I think they were at the same spot over here where their building is in California, over in the American territories. And they did something, or one of them did. Maybe something big, maybe no more than tossing a rock or burying an apple core in the dirt, and it somehow, it echoed over there. It echoed over there, and it killed Jerry Bledsoe. Jack shivered. Oh, yes. He supposed he knew why it had taken his mind so long to cough up the memory, the toy taxi, the murmur of the men's voices, Dexter Gordon blowing his horn. It hadn't wanted to cough it up. Because who plays those changes, Daddy? It suggested that just by being over here, he could be doing something terrible in the other world. Starting World War III? No, probably not. He hadn't assassinated any kings lately, young or old. But how much had it taken to set up the echo which had fried Jerry Bledsoe? Had Uncle Morgan shot Jerry's twinner, if Jerry had had one? Tried to sell some territory's bigwig on the concept of electricity? Or had it been just some little thing, something no more earth-shattering than buying a chunk of meat in a rural market town? Who played those changes? What played those changes? A nice flood, a sweet fire. Suddenly Jack's mouth was as dry as salt. He crossed to the little stream by the side of the road, dropped to his knees, and put a hand down to scoop up water. His hand froze suddenly. The smooth-running stream had taken on the colors of the coming sunset. But these colors suddenly suffused with red, so that it seemed to be a stream of blood rather than water running beside the road. Then it went black. A moment later it had become transparent, and Jack saw a little mewling sound escaped him as he saw Morgan's diligence roaring along the western road, pulled by its foaming baker's dozen of black-plumed horses. Jack saw with almost swooning terror that the driver, sitting up high in the peak seat, his booted feet on the splashboard and a ceaselessly cracking whip in one hand, was Elroy. But it was not a hand at all that held that whip. It was some sort of hoof. Elroy was driving that nightmare coach, Elroy grinning with a mouth that was filled with dead fangs, Elroy who just couldn't wait to find Jack Sawyer again and split open Jack Sawyer's belly and pull out Jack Sawyer's intestines. Jack knelt before the stream, eyes bulging, mouth quivering with dismay and horror. He had seen one final thing in this vision, not a large thing, no, but by implication it was the most frightful thing of all. The eyes of the horses seemed to glow. They seemed to glow because they were full of light, full of the sunset. The diligence was traveling west along this same road, and it was after him. Crawling, not sure he could stand even if he had to, Jack retreated from the stream and lurched clumsily out into the road. He fell flat in the dust, Speedy's bottle and the mirror the rug salesman had given him digging into his guts. He turned his head sideways so that his right cheek and ear were pressed tightly against the surface of the western road. He could feel the steady rumble in the hard, dry earth. It was distant, but coming closer. Elroy up on top, Morgan inside. Morgan Sloat, Morgan of Oris. Didn't matter, both were one. He broke the hypnotic effect of that rumbling in the earth with an effort and got up again. He took Speedy's bottle, the same over here in the territories as in the USA, out of his jerkin, and pulled as much as the moss plug out of the neck as he could, never minding the shower of particles into the little bit of liquid remaining, no more than a couple of inches now. He looked nervously to his left, as if expecting to see the black diligence appear at the horizon, the sunset-filled eyes of the horses glowing like weird lanterns. Of course, he saw nothing. Horizons were closer over here in the territories, as he had already noticed, and sounds traveled farther. Morgan's diligence had to be 10 miles to the east, maybe as much as 20. "Still right on top of me," Jack thought, and raised the bottle to his lips. A bare second before he drank from it, his mind shouted, "Hey, wait a minute, dummy, you want to get killed?" He would look cute, wouldn't he, standing in the middle of the western road and then flipping back into the other world in the middle of some road over there, maybe getting run down by a highballing semi or a UPS truck. Jack shambled over to the side of the road and then walked 10 or 20 paces into the thigh-high grass for good measure. He took one final deep breath, inhaling the sweet smell of this place, groping for that feeling of serenity, that feeling of rainbow. "Gotta try and remember how that felt," he thought. "I may need it, and I may not get back here for a long time." He looked out at the grasslands, darkening now as night stole over them from the east. The wind gusted, chilly now, but still fragrant, tossing his hair. It was getting shaggy now as it tossed the grass. "You ready, Jacko?" Jack closed his eyes and steeled himself against the awful taste and the vomiting that was apt to follow. "Banzai," he whispered, and drank. Chapter 14. Buddy Parkins. He vomited up a thin, purple drool, his face only inches from the grass covering the long slope down to a four-lane highway, shook his head and rocked backward onto his knees so that only his back was exposed to the heavy gray sky. The world, this world, stank. Jack pushed himself backward, away from the threads of puke settling over the blades of grass, and the stench altered but did not diminish. Gasoline, other nameless poisons floated in the air, and the air itself stank of exhaustion, fatigue. Even the noises roaring up from the highway punished this dying air. The back end of a road sign reared like a gigantic television screen over his head. Jack wobbled to his feet. Far down the other side of the highway glinted an endless body of water, only slightly less gray than the sky. A sort of malignant luminescence darted across the surface. From here, too, rose an odor of metal filings and tired breath. Lake Ontario and the snug little city down there might be Olcott or Kendall. He'd gone miles out of his way, lost 100 miles or more in just about 4.5 days. Jack stepped under the sign, hoping it was no worse than that. He looked up at the black letters, wiped his mouth. Angola. Angola? Where was that? He peered down at the smoky little city through the already nearly tolerable air. And Rand McNally, that invaluable companion, told him that the acres of water way down there were Lake Erie. Instead of losing days of travel time, he had gained them. But before the boy could decide that he'd be smarter after all if he jumped back into the territories as soon as he thought it might be safe, which is to say as soon as Morgan's diligence had roared long past the place he had been, before he could do that, before he could even begin to think about doing that, he had to go down into the smoky little city of Angola and see if this time Jack Sawyer, Jacko, had played any of those changes, Daddy. He began to make his way down the slope, a 12-year-old boy in jeans and a plaid shirt, tall for his age, already beginning to look uncared for, with suddenly too much worry in his face. Halfway down the long slope, he realized that he was thinking in English again. Many days later, and a long way west, the man, Buddy Parkins by name, who just out of Cambridge, Ohio, on U.S. 40, had picked up a tall boy, calling himself Lewis Farron, would have recognized that look of worry. This kid Lewis looked like worry was about to sink into his face for good. "Lighten up, son, for your own sake, if no one else's," Buddy wanted to tell the boy. But the boy had enough troubles for 10, according to his story. Mother sick, father dead, sent off to some schoolteacher aunt in Buckeye Lake. Lewis Farron had plenty to trouble him. He looked as though he had not seen as much as $5 altogether since the previous Christmas. Still, Buddy thought that somewhere along the line, this Farron kid was jiving him. For one thing, he smelled like farm, not town. Buddy Parkins and his brothers ran 300 acres not far from Amanda, about 30 miles southeast of Columbus, and Buddy knew that he could not be wrong about this. The boy smelled like Cambridge, and Cambridge was country. Buddy had grown up with the smell of farmland and barnyard, of manure and growing corn and pea vineries, and the unwashed clothes of this boy beside him had absorbed all these familiar odors. And there were the clothes themselves. Mrs. Farron must have been awful sick, Buddy thought, if she sent her boy off down the road in ripped jeans so stiff with dirt the wrinkles seemed bronzed. And the shoes. Lewis Farron's sneakers were about to fall off his feet, the laces all spliced together, and the fabric split or worn through in a couple of places on each shoe. "So they got your daddy's car, did they, Lewis?" Buddy asked. "Just like I said, that's right. The lousy cowards came out after midnight and just stole it right out of the garage. I don't think they should be allowed to do that. Not from people who work hard and really are going to start making their payments as soon as they can. I mean, do you? You don't, do you?" The boy's honest, sunburned face was turned toward him as if this were the most serious question since the Nixon pardon, or maybe the Bay of Pigs. And all Buddy's instincts were to agree. He would be inclined to agree with any generally good-hearted opinion uttered by a boy so redolent of farm work. "I guess there's two sides to everything when you come down to it," Buddy Perkins said, not very happily. The boy blinked, and then turned away to face forward again. Again, Buddy felt his anxiety, the cloud of worry that seemed to hang over the boy, and was almost sorry he had not given Lewis Farron the agreement he seemed to need. "I suppose your aunt's in the grade school there in Buckeye Lake," Buddy said, at least in part hoping to lighten the boy's misery, point to the future, not the past.
"Yes, sir, that's right. She teaches in the grade school, Helen Vaughn."
His expression did not change. But Buddy had heard it again. He didn't consider himself any Henry Higgins, the professor guy in that musical, but he knew for certain sure that young Lewis Farron didn't talk like anyone who had been raised in Ohio. The kid's voice was all wrong, too pushed together and full of the wrong ups and downs. It wasn't an Ohio voice at all. It especially was not a rural Ohioan's voice. It was an accent. Or was it possible that some boy from Cambridge, Ohio, could learn to talk like that, whatever his crazy reason might be? But he supposed it was. On the other hand, the newspaper, this Lewis Farron, had never once unclamped from beneath his left elbow, seemed to validate Buddy Parkin's deepest and worst suspicion that his fragrant young companion was a runaway and his every word a lie. The name of the paper, visible to Buddy with only the slightest tilt of his head, was the Angola Herald. There was that Angola in Africa that a lot of Englishmen had rushed off to as mercenaries, and there was Angola, New York, right up there on Lake Erie. He'd seen pictures of it on the news not long ago, but could not quite remember why. "I'd like to ask you a question, Lewis," he said, and cleared his throat.
"Yes?" the boy said.
"How come a boy from a nice little burg on U.S. 40 is carrying around a paper from Angola, New York? Which is one hell of a long way away. I'm just curious, son." The boy looked down at the paper flattened under his arm and hugged it even closer to him, as if he were afraid it might squirm away.
"Oh," he said. "I found it."
"Oh, hell," Buddy said.
"Yes, sir. It was on a bench at the bus station back home."
"You went to the bus station this morning?"
"Right before I decided to save the money and hitch. Mr. Parkins, if you can get me to the turnoff at Zanesville, I'll only have a short ride left. Could probably get to my aunt's house before dinner."
"Could be," Buddy said, and drove in an uncomfortable silence for several miles. Finally, he could bear it no longer, and he said very quietly and while looking straight ahead, "Son, are you running away from home?" Lewis Farron astonished him by smiling. Not grinning and not faking it, but actually smiling. He thought the whole notion of running away from home was funny. It tickled him. The boy glanced at him a fraction of a second after Buddy had looked sideways, and their eyes met. For a second, for 2 seconds, three, for however long that moment lasted, Buddy Parkin saw that this unwashed boy sitting beside him was beautiful. He would have thought himself incapable of using that word to describe any male human being above the age of 9 months, but underneath the road grime, this Lewis Farron was beautiful. His sense of humor had momentarily murdered his worries, and what shone out of him at Buddy, who was 52 years old and had 3 teenage sons, was a kind of straightforward goodness that had only been dented by a host of unusual experiences. This Lewis Farron, 12 years old by his own account, had somehow gone farther and seen more than Buddy Parkins, and what he had seen and done had made him beautiful.
"No, I'm not a runaway, Mr. Parkins," the boy said.
Then he blinked, and his eyes went inward again and lost their brightness, their light, and the boy slumped back again against his seat. He pulled up a knee, rested it on the dashboard, and snugged the newspaper up under his bicep.
"No, I guess not," Buddy Parkins said, snapping his eyes back to the highway.
He felt relieved, though he was not quite sure why.
"I guess you're not a runaway, Lewis. You're something, though."
The boy did not respond.
"Been working on a farm, haven't you?"
Lewis looked up at him, surprised.
"I did, yeah. the past 3 days, $2 an hour. And your mommy didn't even take the time out from being sick to wash her clothes before she sent you to her sister. Is that right? Buddy thought. But what he said was, Lewis, I'd like you to think about coming home with me. I'm not saying you're on the run or anything, but if you're from anywhere around Cambridge, I'll eat this beat-up old car, tires and all. And I got 3 boys myself, and the youngest one, Billy, he's only about 3 years older than you, and we know how to feed boys around my house. You can stay about as long as you like, depending on how many questions you want to answer, because I'll be asking them, at least after the first time we break bread together. He rubbed one palm over his gray crew cut and glanced across the seat. Lewis Farron was looking more like a boy and less like a revelation. You'll be welcome, son. Smiling, the boy said, That's really nice of you, Mr. Parkins, but I can't. I have to go see my, aunt in Buckeye Lake, Buddy supplied. The boy swallowed and looked forward again. I'll give you help if you want help, Buddy repeated. Lewis patted his forearm, sunburned and thick. This ride is a big help, honest. 10 nearly silent minutes later, he was watching the boy's forlorn figure trudge down the exit ramp outside Zanesville. Emmy would probably have brained him if he'd come home with a strange, dirty boy to feed. But once she'd seen him and talked to him, Emmy would have brought out the good glasses and the plates her mother had given her. Buddy Parkins didn't believe that there was any woman named Helen Vaughn in Buckeye Lake, and he wasn't so sure this mysterious Lewis Farron even had a mother. The boy seemed such an orphan, off on a vast errand. Buddy watched until the boy was taken by the curve of the off-ramp, and he was staring out at space and the enormous yellow and purple sign of a shopping mall. For a second, he thought of jumping out of the car and running after the kid, trying to get him back. And then he had a moment of recall of a crowded, smoky scene on the 6 o'clock news. Angola, New York. Some disaster too small to be reported more than once. That was what had happened in Angola, one of those little tragedies the world shovels under a mountain of newsprint. All Buddy could catch in this short, probably flawed moment of memory was a picture of girders strewn like giant straws over battered cars jutting up out of a fuming hole in the ground, a hole that might lead down into hell. Buddy Parkins looked once more at the empty place on the road where the boy had been, and then stamped on his clutch and dropped the old car into low. Buddy Parkins' memory was more accurate than he imagined. If he could have seen the first page of the month-old Angola Herald, Lewis Farron, that enigmatic boy had been holding so protectively yet fearfully beneath his arm, these are the words he would have read. Freak Earthquake Kills 5 by Herald staff reporter Joseph Gargan. Work on the Rainbird Towers, intended to be Angola's tallest and most luxurious condominium development, and still 6 months from completion, was tragically halted yesterday as an unprecedented earth tremor collapsed the structure of the building, burying many construction workers beneath the rubble. 5 bodies have been retrieved from the ruins of the proposed condominium, and 2 other workers have not yet been found, but are presumed dead. All 7 workers were welders and fitters in the employ of Spicer Construction, and all were on the girders of the building's top 2 floors at the time of the incident. Yesterday's tremor was the first earthquake in Angola's recorded history. Armin Van Pelt of New York University's geology department, contacted today by telephone, described the fatal quake as a seismic bubble. Representatives of the State Safety Commission are continuing their examinations of the site, as is a team of... The dead men were Robert Heidel, 23, Thomas Thielke, 34, Jerome Wild, 48, Michael Hagen, 29, and Bruce Davey, 39. The 2 men still missing were Arnold Schulkamp, 54, and Theodore Rasmussen, 43. Jack no longer had to look at the newspaper's front page to remember their names. The first earthquake in the history of Angola, New York, had occurred on the day he had flipped away from the western road and landed on the town's border.
Part of Jack Sawyer wished that he could have gone home with big, kindly Buddy Parkins, eaten dinner around the table in the kitchen with the Parkins family, boiled beef and deep-dish apple pie, and then snuggled into the Parkins's guest bed and pulled the homemade quilt up over his head, and not moved except toward the table for 4 or 5 days. But part of the trouble was that he saw that knotty pine kitchen table heaped with crumbly cheese, and on the other side of the table a mouse hole was cut into a giant baseboard, and from holes in the jeans of the 3 Parkins boys protruded thin, long tails. "Who plays these Jerry Bledsoe changes, Daddy? Heidel, Thielke, Wild, Hagen, Davy, Schulkamp, and Rasmussen. Those Jerry changes." He knew who played them. The huge yellow and purple sign reading Buckeye Mall floated ahead of Jack as he came around the final curve of the off-ramp, drifted past his shoulder, and reappeared on his other side, at which point he could finally see that it was erected on a tripod of tall yellow poles in the shopping center parking lot. The mall itself was a futuristic assemblage of ochre-colored buildings that seemed to be windowless. A second later, Jack realized that the mall was covered, and what he was seeing was only the illusion of separate buildings. He put his hand in his pocket and fingered the tight roll of 23 single-dollar bills, which was his earthly fortune. In the cool sunlight of an early autumn afternoon, Jack sprinted across the street toward the mall's parking lot. If it had not been for his conversation with Buddy Parkins, Jack would very likely have stayed on U.S. 40 and tried to cover another 50 miles. He wanted to get to Illinois, where Richard Sloat was, in the next 2 or 3 days. The thought of seeing his friend Richard again had kept him going during the weary days of non-stop work on Albert Palamountain's farm. The image of spectacled, serious-faced Richard Sloat in his room at Thayer School in Springfield, Illinois, had fueled him as much as Mrs. Palamountain's generous meals. Jack still wanted to see Richard, and as soon as he could, but Buddy Parkins inviting him home had somehow unstrung him. He could not just climb into another car and begin all over again on the story. In any case, Jack reminded himself, the story seemed to be losing its potency. The shopping mall gave him a perfect chance to drop out for an hour or two, especially if there was a movie theater somewhere in there. Right now, Jack could have watched the dullest, soppiest love story of a movie. And before the movie, were he lucky enough to find a theater, he would be able to take care of 2 things he had been putting off for at least a week. Jack had seen Buddy Parkins looking at his disintegrating Nikes. Not only were the running shoes falling apart, the soles, once spongy and elastic, had mysteriously become hard as asphalt. On days when he had to walk great distances, or when he had to work standing up all day, his feet stung as if they'd been burned. The second task, calling his mother, was so loaded with guilt and other fearful emotions that Jack could not quite allow it to become conscious. He did not know if he could keep from weeping once he'd heard his mother's voice. What if she sounded weak? What if she sounded really sick? Could he really keep going west if Lily hoarsely begged him to come back to New Hampshire? So he could not admit to himself that he was probably going to call his mother. His mind gave him the suddenly very clear image of a bank of pay telephones beneath their hair-dryer plastic bubbles, and almost immediately backed away from it, as if Elroy or some other territory's creature could reach right out of the receiver and clamp a hand around his throat. Just then, 3 girls, a year or 2 older than Jack, bounced out of the back of a Subaru Brat which had swung recklessly into a parking spot near the mall's main entrance. For a second, they had the look of models contorted into awkwardly elegant poses of delight and astonishment. When they had adjusted into more conventional postures, the girls glanced incuriously at Jack and began to flip their hair expertly back into place. They were leggy in their tight jeans, these confident little princesses of the 10th grade, and when they laughed, they put their hands over their mouths in a fashion which suggested that laughter itself was laughable. Jack slowed his walk into a kind of sleepwalker's stroll. One of the princesses glanced at him and muttered something to the brown-haired girl beside her. "I'm different now," Jack thought. "I'm not like them anymore." The recognition pierced him with loneliness. A thick-set, blonde boy in a blue sleeveless down vest climbed out of the driver's seat and gathered the girls around him by the simple expedient of pretending to ignore them. The boy, who must have been a senior and at the very least in the varsity backfield, glanced once at Jack, and then looked appraisingly at the facade of the mall.
"Timmy?" said the tall brown-haired girl.
"Yeah, yeah," the boy said. "I was just wondering what smells like shit out here." He rewarded the girls with a superior little smile. The brown-haired girl looked smirkingly toward Jack, then swung herself across the asphalt with her friends. The three girls followed Timmy's arrogant body through the glass doors into the mall. Jack waited until the figures of Timmy and his court, visible through the glass, had shrunk to the size of puppies far down the long mall, before he stepped on the plate which opened the doors. Cold, pre-digested air embraced him. Water trickled down over a fountain 2 stories high, set in a wide pool surrounded by benches. Open-fronted shops on both levels faced the fountain. Bland muzak drifted down from the ochre ceiling, as did the peculiar bronzy light. The smell of popcorn, which had struck Jack the moment the glass doors had whooshed shut behind him, emanated from an antique popcorn wagon, painted fire engine red, and stationed outside a Walden Books to the left of the fountain on the ground level. Jack had seen immediately that there was no movie theater in the Buckeye Mall. Timmy and his leggy princesses were floating up the escalator at the mall's other end, making, Jack thought, for a fast food restaurant called the Captain's Table, right at the top of the escalator. Jack put his hand in his pants pocket again and touched his roll of bills. Speedy's guitar pick and Captain Farron's coin nested at the bottom of the pocket, along with a handful of dimes and quarters. On Jack's level, sandwiched between a Mr. Chip's cookie shop and a liquor store advertising new low prices for Hiram Walker Bourbon and Inglenook Chablis, a Fava shoe store drew him toward its long table of running shoes. The clerk at the cash register leaned forward and watched Jack pick over the shoes, clearly suspicious that he might try to steal something. Jack recognized none of the brands on the table. There were no Nikes or Pumas here. They were called Speedster or Bullseye or Zooms, and the laces of each pair were tied together. These were sneakers, not true running shoes. They were good enough, Jack supposed. He bought the cheapest pair the store had in his size, blue canvas with red zigzag stripes down the sides. No brand name was visible anywhere on the shoes. They seemed indistinguishable from most of the other shoes on the table. At the register, he counted out 6 limp $1 bills and told the clerk that he did not need a bag. Jack sat on one of the benches before the tall fountain and towed off the battered Nikes without bothering to unlace them. When he slipped on the new sneakers, his feet fairly sighed with gratitude. Jack left the bench and dropped his old shoes in a tall black wastebasket with "Don't Be a Litterbug" stenciled on it in white. Beneath that, in smaller letters, the wastebasket read, "The Earth is our only home." Jack began to move aimlessly through the long lower arcade of the mall, searching for the telephones. At the popcorn wagon, he parted with 50 cents and was handed a quart-sized tub of fresh popcorn glistening with grease. The middle-aged man in a bowler hat, a walrus mustache, and sleeve garters who sold him the popcorn told him that the payphones were around a corner next to 31 Flavors upstairs. The man gestured vaguely toward the nearest escalator. Scooping the popcorn into his mouth, Jack rode up behind a woman in her 20s and an older woman with hips so wide they nearly covered the entire width of the escalator, both of them in pantsuits. If Jack were to flip inside the Buckeye Mall, or even a mile or two from it, would the walls shake and the ceiling crumbled down, dropping bricks and beams and muzak speakers and light fixtures down on everybody unlucky enough to be inside? And would the 10th-grade princesses and even arrogant Timmy and most of the others, too, wind up with skull fractures and severed limbs and mangled chests and... For a second, just before he reached the top of the escalator, Jack saw giant chunks of plaster and metal girders showering down, heard the terrible cracking of the mezzanine floor, the screams, too, inaudible, they were still printed in the air. Angola. The Rainbird Towers. Jack felt his palms begin to itch and sweat, and he wiped them on his jeans. 31 flavors gleamed out a chilly, incandescent white light to his left, and when he turned that way, he saw a curving hallway on its other side. Shiny brown tiles on the walls and floor. As soon as the curve of the hallway took him out of sight of anyone on the mezzanine level, Jack saw three telephones, which were indeed under transparent plastic bubbles. Across the hall from the telephones were doors to men and ladies. Beneath the middle bubble, Jack dialed 0, followed by the area code and the number for the Alhambra Inn and Gardens. "Billing?" asked the operator, and Jack said, "This is a collect call for Mrs. Sawyer in 407 and 408 from Jack." The hotel operator answered, and Jack's chest tightened. She transferred the call to the suite. The telephone rang once, twice, three times. Then his mother said, "Jesus, kid, I'm glad to hear from you. This absentee mother business is hard on an old girl like me. I kind of miss you when you're not moping around and telling me how to act with waiters." "You're just too classy for most waiters, that's all," Jack said, and thought that he might begin to cry with relief. "Are you all right, Jack? Tell me the truth." "I'm fine, sure," he said. "Yeah, I'm fine. I just had to make sure that you, you know." The phone whispered electronically, a skirl of static that sounded like sand blowing across a beach. "I'm okay," Lily said. "I'm great. I'm not any worse, anyhow, if that's what you're worried about. I suppose I'd like to know where you are." Jack paused, and the static whispered and hissed for a moment. "I'm in Ohio now. Pretty soon I'm going to be able to see Richard." "When are you coming home, Jacko?" "I can't say. I wish I could." "You can't say. I swear, kid, if your father hadn't called you that silly name, and if you'd asked me about this 10 minutes earlier or 10 minutes later..." A rising tide of static took her voice, and Jack remembered how she'd looked in the tea shop, haggard and feeble, an old woman. When the static receded, he asked, "Are you having any trouble with Uncle Morgan? Is he bothering you?" "I sent your Uncle Morgan away from here with a flea in his ear," she said. "He was there? He did come? Is he still bothering you?" "I got rid of the stoat about 2 days after you left, baby. Don't waste time worrying about him." "Did he say where he was going?" Jack asked her, but as soon as the words were out of his mouth, the telephone uttered a tortured electronic squeal that seemed to bore right into his head. Jack grimaced and jerked the receiver away from his ear. The awful whining noise of static was so loud that anyone stepping into the corridor would have heard it. "Mom!" Jack shouted, putting the phone as close to his head as he dared. The squeal of static increased, as if a radio between stations had been turned up to full volume. The line abruptly fell silent. Jack clamped the receiver to his ear and heard only the flat black silence of dead air. "Hey," he said, and jiggled the hook. The flat silence in the phone seemed to press up against his ear. Just as abruptly, and as if his jiggling the hook had caused it, the dial tone, an oasis of sanity, of regularity now, resumed. Jack jammed his right hand in his pocket, looking for another coin. He was holding the receiver, awkwardly, in his left hand as he dug in his pocket. He froze when he heard the dial tone suddenly slot off into outer space. Morgan Sloat's voice spoke to him, as clearly as if good old Uncle Morgan were standing at the next telephone. "Get your ass back home, Jack." Sloat's voice carved the air like a scalpel. "You just get your ass back home before we have to take you back ourselves." "Wait," Jack said, as if he were begging for time. In fact, he was too terrified to know quite what he was saying. "Can't wait any longer, little pal. You're a murderer now." "That's right, isn't it? You're a murderer. So we're not able to give you any more chances. You just get your can back to that resort in New Hampshire, now. Or maybe you'll go home in a bag." Jack heard the click of the receiver. He dropped it. The telephone Jack had used shuddered forward, then sagged off the wall. For a second it drooped on a network of wires, then crashed heavily to the floor. The door to the men's room banged open behind Jack, and a voice yelled, "Holy shit!" Jack turned to see a thin, crew-cut boy of about 20 staring at the telephones. He was wearing a white apron and a bow tie, a clerk at one of the shops. "I didn't do it," Jack said. "It just happened." "Holy shit!" The crew-cut clerk goggled at Jack for a split second, jerked as if to run, and then ran his hands over the crown of his head. Jack backed away down the hall. When he was halfway down the escalator, he finally heard the clerk yelling, "Mr. Olofsson, the phone! Mr. Olofsson!" Jack fled. Outside, the air was bright, surprisingly humid. Dazed, Jack wandered across the sidewalk. A half mile away across the parking lot, a black and white police car swung in toward the mall. Jack turned sideways and began to walk down the pavement. Some way ahead, a family of six struggled to get a lawn chair in through the next entrance to the mall. Jack slowed down and watched the husband and wife tilt the lawn chair diagonally, hindered by the attempts of the smaller children to either sit on the chair or to assist them. At last, nearly in the posture of the flag raisers in the famous photograph of Iwo Jima, the family staggered through the door. The police car lazily circled through the big parking lot. Just past the door, where the disorderly family had succeeded in planting their chair, an old black man sat on a wooden crate, cradling a guitar in his lap. As Jack slowly drew nearer, he saw the metal cup beside the man's feet. The man's face was hidden behind big, dirty sunglasses and beneath the brim of a stained felt hat. The sleeves of his denim jacket were as wrinkled as an elephant's hide. Jack swerved out to the edge of the pavement to give the man all the room he seemed to warrant, and noticed that around the man's neck hung a sign, handwritten in big, shaky capital letters on discolored white cardboard. A few steps later, he could read the letters. "Blind since birth, will play any song, God bless you." He had nearly walked past the man holding the beat-up old guitar when he heard him utter, his voice a cracked and juicy whisper, "Yeah, Bob." Chapter 15. Snowball Sings. Jack swung back toward the black man, his heart hammering in his chest. "Speedy?" The black man groped for his cup, held it up, shook it. A few coins rattled in the bottom. "It is Speedy. Behind those dark glasses, it is Speedy." Jack was sure of it. But a moment later, he was just as sure that it wasn't Speedy. Speedy wasn't built square in the shoulders and broad across the chest. Speedy's shoulders were rounded, a little slumped over, and his chest consequently had a slightly caved-in look. Mississippi John Hurt, not Ray Charles. But I could tell one way or the other for sure if he'd take off those shades. He opened his mouth to speak Speedy's name aloud, and suddenly the old man began to play, his wrinkled fingers as dully dark as old walnut that has been faithfully oiled but never polished, moving with limber speed and grace on both strings and frets. He played well, finger-picking the melody, and after a moment Jack recognized the tune. It had been on one of his father's older records, a Vanguard album called Mississippi John Hurt Today. And although the blind man didn't sing, Jack knew the words. "Oh, kindly friends, tell me ain't it hard to see old Lewis in a new graveyard. The angels laid him away." The blond football player and his three princesses came out of the mall's main doors. Each of the princesses had an ice cream cone. Mr. All-America had a chili dog in each hand. They sauntered toward where Jack stood. Jack, whose whole attention was taken up by the old black man, had not even noticed them. He had been transfixed by the idea that it was Speedy, and Speedy had somehow read his mind. How else could it be that this man had begun to play a Mississippi John Hurt composition just as Jack happened to think Speedy looked like that very man, and a song containing his own road name as well? The blonde football player transferred both chili dogs to his left hand and slapped Jack on the back with his right as hard as he could. Jack's teeth snapped on his own tongue like a bear trap. The pain was sudden and excruciating. "You just shake her easy, urine breath," he said. The princesses giggled and shrieked. Jack stumbled forward and kicked over the blind man's cup. Coins spilled and rolled. The gentle lilt of the blues tune came to a jangling halt. Mr. All-America and the three little princesses were already moving on. Jack stared after them and felt the now familiar, impotent hate. This was how it felt to be on your own, just young enough to be at everyone's mercy and to be anyone's meat, anyone from a psychotic like Osmond to a humorless old Lutheran like Albert Palamon, whose idea of a pretty fair workday was to slog and squelch through gluey fields for 12 hours during a steady, cold downpour of October rain, and to sit bolt upright in the cab of his International Harvester truck during lunch hour, eating onion sandwiches and reading from the Book of Job. Jack had no urge to get them, although he had a strange idea that if he wanted to, he could, that he was gaining some sort of power, almost like an electrical charge. It sometimes seemed to him that other people knew that, too, that it was in their faces when they looked at him. But he didn't want to get them. He only wanted to be left alone. The blind man was feeling around himself for the spilled money, his pudgy hands moving gently over the pavement, almost seeming to read it. He happened on a dime, set his cup back up again, and dropped the dime in. Plink! Faintly, Jack heard one of the princesses. "Why do they let him stay there? He's so gross, you know." Even more faintly still, "Yeah, really." Jack got down on his knees and began to help, picking up coins and putting them into the blind man's cup. Down here, close to the old man, he could smell sour sweat, mildew, and some sweet, bland smell like corn. Smartly dressed mall shoppers gave them a wide berth. "Thank you, thank you," the blind man croaked monotonously. Jack could smell dead chili on his breath. "Thank you. Bless you. God bless you. Thank you." "He is speedy. He's not speedy." What finally forced him to speak, and this was not really so odd, was remembering just how little of the magic juice he had left. Barely 2 swallows now. He did not know if after what had happened in Angola he could ever bring himself to travel in the territories again, but he was still determined to save his mother's life, and that meant he might have to. And whatever the talisman was, he might have to flip into the other world to get it. "Speedy?
Bless you. Thank you. God bless you. Didn't I hear one go over there?"
He pointed.
"Speedy, it's Jack."
"Ain't nothing speedy round here, boy. No, sir."
His hands began to whisper walk along the concrete in the direction he had just pointed. One of them found a nickel, and he dropped it into the cup. His other happened to touch the shoe of a smartly dressed young woman who was passing by, her pretty, empty face wrinkled in almost painful disgust as she drew away from him. Jack picked the last coin out of the gutter. It was a silver dollar, a big old cartwheel with Lady Liberty on one side. Tears began to spill out of his eyes. They ran down his dirty face, and he wiped them away with an arm that shook. He was crying for Thielke, Wilde, Hagen, Davy, and Heidel, for his mother, for Laura de Loessian, for the carter's son lying dead in the road with his pockets turned out. But most of all, for himself. He was tired of being on the road. Maybe when you rode it in a Cadillac it was a road of dreams, but when you had to hitch it, riding on your thumb in a story that was just about worn out, when you were at everybody's mercy and anyone's meat, it was nothing but a road of trials. Jack felt that he had been tried enough, but there was no way to cry it off. If he cried it off, the cancer would take his mother, and Uncle Morgan might well take him.
"I don't think I can do it, Speedy," he wept. "I don't think so, man."
Now the blind man groped for Jack instead of the spilled coins. Those gentle, weeding fingers found his arm and closed around it. Jack could feel the hard pad of callus in the tip of each finger. He drew Jack to him into those odors of sweat and heat and old chili, Jack pressed his face against Speedy's chest.
"Oh, boy, I don't know no Speedy, but it sounds like you putting an awful lot on him.
I miss my mom, Speedy," Jack wept, "and Sloat's after me. It was him on the phone inside the mall. Him! And that's not the worst thing. The worst thing was in Angola, the Rainbird Towers. Earthquake. 5 men. Me, I did it, Speedy. I killed those men when I flipped into this world. I killed them just like my dad and Morgan Sloat killed Jerry Bledsoe that time."
Now it was out. The worst of it. He had sicked up the stone of guilt that had been in his throat, threatening to choke him, and a storm of weeping seized him. But this time it was relief rather than fear. It was said. It had been confessed. He was a murderer.
"Hoo-wee!"
the black man cried. He sounded perversely delighted. He held Jack with one thin, strong arm, rocked him.
"You trying to carry you one heavy load, boy. You sure am. Maybe you ought to put some of it down."
"I killed him," Jack whispered. "Thielke, Wild, Hagen, David—"
"Well, if your friend Speedy was here," the black man said, "whoever he might be or wherever he might be in this wide old world, he might tell you that you can't carry the world on your shoulders, son. You can't do that. No one can. Try to carry the world on your shoulders, why, first it's gonna break your back, and then it's gonna break your spirit."
"I killed,
put a gun to their heads and shot somebody, did you?"
"No, the earthquake. I flipped—"
"Don't know nothing about that,"
the black man said. Jack had pulled away from him a bit and was staring up into the black man's seamed face with wondering curiosity. But the black man had turned his head toward the parking lot. If he was blind, then he had picked out the smoother, slightly more powerful beat of the police car's engine from the others as it approached, because he was looking right at it.
"All I know is you seem to have this idea of murder a little broad. Probably if some fella dropped dead of a heart attack going round us as we sit here, you'd think you killed him. Oh, look, I done murdered that fella on account of where I was sitting. Oh, woe, oh, doom, oh, gloom, oh, this, oh, that."
As he spoke this and that, the blind man punctuated it with a quick change from G to C and back to G again. He laughed, pleased with himself.
"Speedy, nothing speedy around here," the black man reiterated, and then showed yellow teeth in a crooked grin. "Except maybe how speedy some folks are to put the blame on themselves for things others might have got started. Maybe you were running, boy, and maybe you being chased."
G chord.
"Maybe you just be a little off base."
C chord, with a nifty little run in the middle that made Jack grin in spite of himself.
"Might be somebody else getting on your case."
Back down to G again, and the blind man laid his guitar aside, while in the police car the two cops were flipping to see which of them would actually have to touch old Snowball if he wouldn't get into the back of the cruiser peaceably.
"Maybe doom and maybe gloom, and maybe this and maybe that."
He laughed again, as if Jack's fears were the funniest thing he'd ever heard.
"But I don't know what could happen if I—"
"No one ever knows what could happen if they do anything, do they?"
the black man, who might or might not be Speedy Parker, broke in.
"No, they do not. If you thought about it, you'd stay in your house all day, as scared to come out. I don't know your problems, boy. Don't want to know 'em. Could be crazy, talking about earthquakes and all. But being as how you helped me pick up my money and didn't steal none, I counted every plinkety-plink, so I know. I give you some advice. Some things you can't help. Sometimes people get killed because somebody does something, but if somebody didn't do that something, a whole lot of more people would have got killed. You see why I'm pushing, son?"
The dirty sunglasses inclined down toward him. Jack felt a deep, shuddery relief. He saw all right. The blind man was talking about hard choices. He was suggesting that maybe there was a difference between hard choices and criminal behavior, and that maybe the criminal wasn't here. The criminal might have been the guy who had told him 5 minutes ago to get his ass home.
"Could even be,"
the blind man remarked, hitting a dark D minor chord on his box,
that all things serve the Lord, just like my mama told me and your mama might have told you if she was a Christian lady. Could be we think we're doing one thing, but are really doing another. Good book says all things, even those that seem evil, serve the Lord. What you think, boy?
I don't know, Jack said honestly. He was all mixed up. He only had to close his eyes, and he could see the telephone tearing off the wall, hanging from its wires like a weird puppet.
Well, it smells like you letting it drive you to drink.
What? Jack asked, astonished. Then he thought, I thought that Speedy looked like Mississippi John Hurt, and this guy started playing a John Hurt blues